were you just saying?
I've seen instruments that have the finish is a real art in itself, being able to put a good finish on an instrument.
What do you do for the finish?
Well, I use a lacquer finish. Like I started to say, I've seen really beautiful work done on making anything, piece of furniture or instrument or anything. And if you can't get a really good finish, it's going to look bad. It looks like bad work. And I've seen reasonably bad work with a beautiful job finishing, and it'll look great.
Dresses it up, yeah.
It makes it look, that's where the secret to the way something looks is in that finish. And I use lacquer.
So how do you go about that? Do you put a lot of thin coats on? Or?
Yeah, the rough process that I use is, you know, just to explain it as simple as I can. The first thing, after you get everything, the wood prepared, you, like if it's some kind of wood that I'm going to stain, sometimes, most of the time you stain mahogany.
Uh-huh.
And you stain it a darker color, and you do that first. I use just a kind you rub on with a rag and keep rubbing until you get the color you want. Any, like mahogany and rosewood, even walnut sometimes, is porous, has little tiny dents all through it. They don't sand out. You sand till the wood's gone, they'll still be there. And so you have to fill them the best you can. They make this stuff called a paste wood filler. It's usually a dark brown. They make it in colors, you know, to match the wood, but I usually use this one color, a dark brown color. And you wipe that stuff on. It looks this nasty looking stuff, just like old thick mud or something. And you wipe it on there and leave it just for a few, you know, seconds. And then you take a heavy rag and wipe it across the grain. Not like sanding or anything. You wipe it crossway. Hmm. And that leaves it stuck in the pores. Leave that way you don't clean it out. If you wipe it straight, it just wipes it right out of the most of them. But if you wipe it sideways and then wipe it all you can to get the streaks that you leave out and get them out the best you can, it's better to leave it dry overnight. And then the next morning, just real lightly sanded a little, just enough to get the streaks from your rag where you were wiping across the grain. And that leaves all those little pores filled up.
Hmm.
And that's a real important step, because if you don't get a good job, you'll end up sanding and spraying a lot more than you normally would. And
Did you do that on the inside and the outside?
No,
or just on the outside?
Just on the outside. And I have seen instruments finished on the inside, at least not really a finish, but I think you just stick a spray gun in there and give it a shot or two.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've never done that. I just don't like the looks of it myself. And when you get that fill job done, if you get a real good job, then the next thing you do is like a sanding sealer, which is a kind of lacquer. And it's like a little thicker and heavier, which goes on quicker and easier than the final coats of lacquer. But that stuff is easy to sand. You shoot a coat on there and then you just sand it down. And what you're trying to do is get rid of those pores.
That's all hand sanding that you're doing, though.
Yeah. Right? You just take your little block or something, this silicon dioxide sandpaper, which is blue, white, blue-colored stuff, about 220 grit, and just sand that finish. It just makes all sorts of dust everywhere. It sands real easily. And then the first time, you don't take a chance on sanding it too much, because you don't want to go through the finish. And then you, after that dries for a couple of hours, you can do that sanding job. And then when you Do it again. Do the same process. Just shoot another coat on there.
How many times altogether?
Well, it depends on how much luck you have getting rid of those pores. You just have to keep going until they're gone.
If it's a good job of getting rid of the pores, about how many coats will you end up putting on?
Probably three. You usually do it about three times. You need to build up a finish. It looks like, when you get done, a real nice finish looks like a little layer of glass over the wood or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that normally will take about three coats.
Is that a real typical way of finishing?
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
Like Martin's might do that? Or?
Yeah, I think that's pretty close to the same process that the Martin Company uses.
How did you find out how to do that? Or what to do?
That's something that I learned some by, you know, hearing about how Martin does it. And mostly just by trying and trial and error. You know, it took years and years to learn how to finish. And that's something I feel like needs more improvement in my work than anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can get buffing machines and things like that, which make the process easier. All that.
And then that's it. And you, well, what about the bridge? You still have to do the bridge and the nut, right?
Yeah. Now I do all this finish. Well, there's still a couple of steps about the that sanding sealer is like softer material and dries easier. And you do like you do those three coats. When you get it sanded down to where there's no pits and pores anywhere that you can find, or any imperfections anywhere, then you're ready to shoot on like anywhere from 2 to 3 coats of lacquer, clear lacquer, which is harder. And sometimes you just sand a coat of that between, like if you get a gnat or a bug or something in it, that's something that needs to be gotten out, you'll sand it. And then try that very last coat, thin it down a little bit, and try to get really a nice, pretty coat on there. That's something I used to do to it, and a lot of people still do, is wet sand that lacquer between coats. You just all the body sandpaper and water.
Mm-hmm.
That's an awful job. I mean, you sit and do that for hours and hours and get nowhere. But I don't do that. I just do that after I try to concentrate on getting really a good job spraying that last coat, then just use the rubbing compound rags and lots of elbow grease and hand rubbing mat. And then after you get the bodies finished and buffed, they're real pretty and shiny, I'll let you glue the neck in.
Oh, you do all that before you put the neck in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do that because you can get such a better job of sanding and buffing and all that finishing right around the end of the body and the fingerboard and around the heel of the neck where it's so be almost impossible to sand it good with that glued in. You mask off the places that you don't, where your glue joints are. And clean that all off, and then it just glues in real nice, and then there's no, you might have to clean off a little glue, but it won't stick to the finished areas anyway. And after you get the neck glued in, you measure how thick you're going to have your bridge. And make your bridge, whatever kind of bridge you make.
What's the bridge usually made out of?
They're usually the same material as the fretboard, either ebony, if it's an ebony board, or a rosewood.
Mm-hmm.
You have to measure it. That's a real important measurement, because if you get it the slightest bit off, your guitar won't tune and play right. When you get that,
is it a proportion, some kind of proportion, or how do you measure
where
it
should
go?
It's like a scale.
Mm-hmm.
Fret scales are, there's different lengths of them. The one that I use is like 25 and 4/10 of an inch long, the one I use on most of my guitars. And that has to be, so your fretboard is laid out a certain way, where the frets are spaced on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And that distance between the little nut up at the peg head and the bridge saddle, where the strings ride across in the bridge, have to be exactly right on that measurement.
Mm-hmm.
It can be off like 1/16 either way,
and
it makes your guitar sound bad and not be able to tune it well.
Oh.
So that has to be exactly right. You just lay out where you measure and mess. I'll lace a piece of thread on it to make sure your string is going to be in the right place up and down at the edges of the board. That's the way you locate where your bridge is going to sit on the top. And when you do that, you take a little sharp scribe, make a scratch around there, and your beautiful finish on your top. And then you start scraping it off under where your bridge is. And you have to be real careful not to scrape outside your mark anywhere, or you make it makes a real ugly mess. When you get that cleaned off real good, just glue your bridge down. And then you have to do lots of little adjustments. You got to cut the notches in your nut, perfect where the string spacing is. That has to be real, really a perfect job doing, or your guitar will be hard to play, and all that kind of stuff. And after you get this all done, you string it up, and then you might have to make adjustments here and there, sometimes it takes a half a day to get everything set up just exactly the way you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start playing it.
What part of that process do students have the most trouble with?
This last time I had a real good student who had almost no trouble making that guitar anywhere, but one little process of bending that herringbone. That tiny little strip.
Mm-hmm.
He did all this stuff with no problem anywhere at all, but he absolutely could not bend that herringbone. Ruined 2 or 3 pieces. And he said that was the hardest thing that he tried to do, which is seems to be such a simple, small thing, you know, which really means nothing. Mm-hmm. Just a little inlay that goes around. Not anything,
right.
Nothing compared to bending sides or making that dovetail joint fit or getting the arch right in the back or something. That, I mean, that's hard things to me. But now, for some reason, he couldn't do that.
What do you think is, you were saying that the finish is something you still need to work on. Is that one of the main things that you're still?
Yeah, that's something I'm still trying to find out better ways of doing it.
But you have the rest of the stuff pretty well down?
Yeah, I think so. There's the way I do it now. It's, I would have to make changes like if I wanted to make a lot of guitars, you know. And I've never been to the Martin factory. The biggest one I've ever been in is Gallagher's place down in Tennessee, probably. But I know that they do things a whole lot the same way we do, but they just do it on a large scale. You know, like when they cut out a little inlay slot for the end of the body on, like where we do on one guitar, they'd do it maybe on 20.
Mm-hmm.
And just set right, up sure. And just whack them all out at once. And I guess that's how they make so many guitars so quick. You know?
Right.
Of course, they've got probably 75 people working in there.
Yeah, lots of people working.
Yeah. And I think I've always wondered how in the world they keep those guitars so nice. You know, they're perfect workmanship on there. And but I figure it's, they say when you have a job working, so they don't look for guitar makers when they hire somebody. They just look, you know, I guess for a good worker, you know. But they
train everybody.
They train you to do one job, like pound in frets or set necks, do the filing that you, or shape a neck, and that mm-hmm. person will do that one job pretty much maybe for years, and they get doggone good at it. You do that one thing.
Sure, and it's real consistent.
Yeah.
And
that's how I think you can have really good quality involved in a big factory like that.
Okay, well, that sounds great, and I think we're all done.
Then you got enough?
Yeah, oh yeah, that'll be fine.
A little bit? Okay. Well, he's a heck of a good guy, and he's funny, and but in a shy kind of way. He's very, very knowledgeable about the whole thing. Last year, he had two great quotes. There was another fellow that was an instrument builder in the class who was always trying to figure out a technical way of assembling a jig and using sophisticated tools to do something so we could have a limited production. And Wayne would walk up to what the two of us were up to, and he'd say, "Well, I guess you fellas can all do it that way. I always done it with a pocket knife." You know, and we'd be trying to figure out how to measure thicknesses and stuff like the same kind of way with some fancy apparatus or not so fancy apparatus. And he'd come up and say, "Well, you fellas could probably go ahead and do it that way. I just always eyeballed it." So that was his two great quotes.
And we started pocket knife or eyeball.
Yeah,
great.
And we started throwing that back at him. "Well, I guess you could just eyeball it." But here in these mandolins, he's doing an excellent job. Now, he's never taught a course in mandolin construction, but we all teach our first course somewhere. And he's not really using all that many patterns. A few patterns. But a lot of the thicknesses and so forth and dimensions and angles that he's working with, he's just doing all from memory. Because he's just, you know, he'll just kind of do it and say, "Well, that's about right." And the first day, Dan asked him, "Well, why are we doing this way? Is there a particular reason?" Wayne just said, "Well, old Lloyd Lohr did it that way."
Who's that?
Lloyd Lohr was a famous mandolin maker for Gibson, who made those F model mandolins. He was an acoustic engineer who would do a lot of testing and fine adjustment, and if they were to his specs, he'd sign the inside of them, and a signed Lloyd Gibson is worth about twice as much as one that isn't. Like Bill Monroe plays a signed Lloyd Lohr, and Wayne's had an opportunity to take apart and work on, you know, Lloyd Lohr Gibsons, and that's mm-hmm. that's the standard of the industry, so to speak.
And so that's what his mandolins are modeled after?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, he tries to, Lloyd Lohr did some improvements over what Orville Gibson had originally created for Gibson mandolins,
mm-hmm.
and Wayne's, you know, basically modeled it after that. I don't really know of any improvements offhand Wayne has done to, you know, mandolins. Wayne has made a different kind of a guitar bridge, which has been written up in, Fretz Magazine, and it's seen as an improvement over the standard guitar bridge. Mm-hmm. Instead of putting all the hitch pins in a line, mm-hmm. which would put them all across the same grain, so if a bridge were to crack, it could crack right along that line. He's put them in an arc, which is aesthetically pleasing. It, you know, makes this look, kind of little smile-looking thing out of the... well, not really.
Or
but
a frown if you turn it upside down.
Right, yeah. It makes it, you know, a curve out of all those little hitch pins.
Right.
And so they're not coming across the same grain line. And
that's wise.
Yeah. It's hard to do something to guitars and mandolins to make them better because people have been working on them for quite a while. Some very innovative people. Anyhow, I'm wondering. You were asking me what he's like as a teacher.
What he's like as a teacher.
Yeah. He's good. This is the sixth instrument I've built. And I've built them all in class settings because I just somehow can't find the time in my life to do it other than setting it aside and paying for it and knowing that it's going to come out right with somebody I can ask a lot of questions to and stuff. He's the best teacher I've had by far, by far. He doesn't have...
How is he different?
He doesn't have any trade secrets. He doesn't have any little things that he'll let his better students know when they look more accomplished, which is a common thing in instrument construction. There's a lot of trade secrets. A lot of people have their ways of doing things that they think is of value, and they don't... A lot of people, particularly in more innovative instruments like, say, hammer dulcimer or harp or something that's in its developmental stages right now, mm-hmm. whereas a guitar and a mandolin were in their developmental stages 100 years ago. People are working on these developments, and they want to, sell licensing agreements, for instance, or have just their shop produce that thing that way, and so they can be a cut above their competition. And when those people wind up in a position of teaching, they're in a bind, whereas Wayne isn't. You know, Gibson developed the mandolin, Martin developed the guitar in a lot of people's eyes, you know, although both companies made both instruments. And what he's really tried to figure out is how they did it, and he's willing to share that with anyone.
That's great.
And
are most of the people who take the class people who've had woodworking or instrument experience before?
Most. Not all, but most. This year it's sort of fascinating that people were able to find the time, and it's also really to Wayne's credit that there's four people in this class. Three of us took the guitar class last year, and the one fella who lives outside of town here took the guitar class last year. Dave Kingslake would probably have come back to build a mandolin if he hadn't lost his house in the flood this year. It's obvious we all love Wayne and really respect his teaching and what he has to offer a whole lot, or he wouldn't have such an incredible rate of, you know, return students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a 75% return rate. You know, I can't think of any class that would have that, you know.
Yeah. How much guidance does he give you, and how much does he let you figure things out on your own?
We are four different people working at four different paces, and there's enough friendship amongst us that if somebody falls behind or is stuck on a certain stage that Wayne has already taught me how to do, I'll show somebody else that. I feel free to ask anybody else questions if they've already done something, which is good because that's moving the class along at the same rate. So when something new comes along...
Share the will.
Well, yeah, Wayne can start talking about what we got to do next, and all four of us are free to be attentive. Which actually Wayne makes no effort on that part. He's just if the next stage comes along and one guy's ready to do it, he'll sit down and show it to that one guy, and he'll teach the same thing four times if the class gets staggered out, because he's happy to do that. He depends how tired he is. It's true for everybody. If he's really tired and you start asking him how to do something, he'll just start doing it for you. You know, he said, "Well, you do like this, you know," and he'll just kind of start doing it. And you sit there and watch him, and maybe some of what he'll be doing is, really mundane, like sitting there scraping away something, and sometimes he'll kind of like show you pointers on how to do it yourself. There are some procedures about a mandolin. There's a real tricky joint fitting the neck to the body, which he did the bulk of the work on most of the instruments. He'd kind of get it so far and then let us putz with it for a while he got somebody else's so far that we really had to rely on him to get that right. Otherwise, we'd still be doing that joint. No, it would just.
So would you say that that's the hardest part of building a mandolin? Is that joint?
That could be.
What about a guitar?
Yeah, that's tricky right there on a guitar too, because it's how that joint comes together is going to mean everything about the instrument in terms of its action.
Uh-huh.
And you want the strings are going to be straight from end to end, and you want the neck centered right under it in the middle. And that's a hard thing to figure out before you've put the strings on. You know, so you got to really kind of like have a good eye for looking at it and figuring out what's going on.
Do you ever take a string and line it up from one end to the other and look how it's going? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly how we did part of it. It's just a piece of thread, really.
Yeah.
Kind of string. I don't know.
Well, that sounds great.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay, thanks.